Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Professor Luke O'Neill, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan. How's it going?
I'm good. You're just back from Vegas.
I am. That's a bit of a secret. I could see you too. Can you believe around the opening night in the Sphere, a huge thrill. And the big thing, I'm so proud, an Irish rock band opening the most high-tech entertainment venue in the world. Isn't it a thrill? You know, it was a great gig.
A triumph of science, was it?
Well, I was in this Sphere thing. I'm thinking you could show DNA with this thing. The graphics, you know, were superb, you know, all these LEDs and all kinds of things. That was going through my mind.
Of course, you're well in there. Bono wrote the blurb for the back of your new book, which is called To Boldly Go, Where No Book Has Gone Before. And it's a history of science. But I was just saying to you there, you told it as stories, so even the scientifically illiterate like myself could get it, and I have a whole new understanding of all kinds of things now. But I was interested in one thing he said. He said, he calls you, Bono does, a disruptive professor in his own class. And disruptive is the word that strikes you right through this book about scientists. But I was thinking of you this week. I was thinking of back when we used to hang on your every word. Remember those days?
How can I forget?
I think I remembered asking you one morning, there was news on vaccines, and I said, is this it? And let's not forget that at that time, there were all kinds of dire predictions that we would never get our lives back again. People saying we'd be in this for 10, 20 years, society would never rebuild. I said to you, is this it? And you said, this is it.
Yep.
And that was the vaccines. So I saw during the week that Kathleen Carrico, am I pronouncing that right? And Drew Weissman won the Nobel Prize this week for their work on those mRNA vaccines. And I was reading, and we'll get on to some other scientists in the book now, but Carrico especially, she was stymied at every turn in this work, wasn't she?
She's a hero of the highest order, man, and typifies the type of people in the book that I'm describing. Yeah. From Hungary, went to America, brought $100 with her. She sewed in $1,000 into her teddy bear, because her daughter's teddy bear. In those days, you couldn't bring money to America from Hungary. Couldn't get a job, went from lab to lab, you know. Stuck at the RNA business, and RNA became the basis for these vaccines.
Yeah.
Made the big discovery in 2005.
And there was no money in RNA, no
research believed her.
Funding.
And she was vilified. Actually, by her colleagues half the time. Her ideas were said to be stupid. She persevered, and that's the key trick of scientists. Huge bravery there. And now look what's happened. Her discovery has saved millions of lives. That's the bottom line. You know,
is that probably so far 20th, 21st century, probably one of the biggest scientific breakthroughs we've seen?
It has to be. Got us out of the pandemic. You're right. Without that RNA technology, we could be stood in the pandemic. It could have taken a lot longer to make a vaccine. That new technology was faster, you know. And of course, safe. Let's emphasize that as well. So her and her colleague Weissman deserve the credit for that technology.
And that was the big thing I took from the book across the whole down the centuries. So scientists are not all squares. They're rebels. They are actually the people who don't accept the status quo. They're the people who ask, you know, why not, aren't they?
Mavericks, disruptors, brave people, like Carrico being an example. You stick your neck out, Brendan, if you make a discovery that's brand new, because you might be wrong, you know, if it's really innovative. Secondly, advances only happen because of disruptors.
Yeah.
And really, really thinking outside the box is the great phrase. And all through history, the scientists that have made a big difference have been rather unusual people, shall we say.
Yeah, give us a good example.
Well, when I wrote the book, I realised it became a series of biographies, really, you know. My favourite is Florence Nightingale. There's some pictures. So she was a famous, as you know, nursing was her big thing, goes to the Crimea. She realises that 42% of soldiers in hospitals are dying of infectious diseases, much more than dying on the battlefield. Introduces, guess what, Brendan, hand washing and hygiene. The germ theory was beginning then. She reads about it, believes it, and introduces all these measures. The death rate falls to 2% in those hospitals. Isn't that incredible? The second thing about her is her father made sure she got a good science education, and that gave her then the skills, you see, and the all about education, really. Yeah. And all the women in the book, by the way, were lucky in the 19th century. They weren't being taught science. They were being taught embroidery or whatever. You know, they all got good educations. And Florence Nightingale, I love her. I always try and find the quirky bit in each scientist in the book as well. She had a pet owl, Brendan, she kept inside her coat.
Yeah.
And she would produce at meetings occasionally, right? The last thing about her is she was the first female member of the Royal College of Statisticians. big into stats, you know, numbers of people dying, all the, she was the first to use pie charts, you know, these things called pie charts. There's an example. Vilified in our time, nobody believed her, trying to get money to fund hospitals.
And you know, the data is everything.
The data is everything.
We make all our decisions based on the data at this stage,
Exactly.
A lot of the discoveries then in the book are kind of accidents or things come to people in dreams.
Serendipity. In my lab as well, often you have to stumble into something, you see. You need to be able to, prepared mind is the key to this, obviously, you know. But the advances happen sometimes by accident. My favourite there is Alexander Fleming. Now, he's famous for antibiotics, which have saved hundreds and hundreds of millions of lives. He had a filthy, dirty lab. Isn't that correct? Didn't clean up. And lo and behold, a fungus contaminates one of his bacterial cultures, kills the bacteria. He goes, that's interesting. And he said, I'll find out what's going on here. And then he begins to pursue penicillin as his big discovery. So again, it's strange how these discoveries happen. You know?
Scientists are often also influenced by this stuff happening in their home lives, like Louis Pasteur, another great guy on germs and all that kind of thing, lost three children to typhoid. And not to make too much of it, but your mother died of cancer when you were 17, and that was a rough death back then, wasn't it?
It was breast cancer, which was really tough. And I was 12 when she was diagnosed. And in those days, Bernard, it was barbaric, really, how they treated women, not because of any fault of people, mastectomy, high-dose steroids, all that kind of stuff. And then she suffered for 5 years. And then sadly, and then when I was 17, she passed away. And my memory there is I go and visit her in St. Michael's Hospital. And I noticed the biochemistry lab beside the ward she was in. What's that? You know? And I began thinking about biochemistry. Looking back at it now, I think it must have had an influence on my decision to get into medical research.
And you're left with your dad then. He was an interesting kind of character. And again, you can see the germs of you in him. He was had been a soldier and kind of a bit of a hippie by the time you came along.
He was born in Westport in the west of Ireland. And when he was a baby, his father died. And his mother emigrates to Salford, a famous city in the UK, of course. And he grew up in Salford in the 1920s, the most polluted city in Europe, he used to say to me. And then he turns 20 and World War II breaks out and he's conscripted. He never volunteered. He made that very clear. Ends up, like all his generation, fighting. He drove a tank through the desert, you know, and he had a very tough war. And I think we all think of PTSD, effectively, you know, when he came back from the war. Goes to Bray. His mother, and go back to Ireland, by the way, goes to visit his mother and then meets my mother, who was from Bray. But my memory of him is a peacenik ahead of his time. One great memory I have is when I was like 6 years of age, he had me up and down the hall with a placard protesting against the Vietnam War. This kind of thing. The chant for him was, "Hey LBJ, how many kids have you killed today?" That was it. So I'll never forget that. And he was very much an outsider himself. He never held down a proper job, really. And we think it was because of this PTSD. Didn't trust him, society, because of what had happened to him in World War II. So
when did you realise what PTSD was?
Well, my memory of him was he quite a happy-go-lucky kind of fed. He didn't reveal it to me. It was after my mother died that he kind of had big trouble. And that often happens with veterans, by the way. Their spouse carries the burden, you know. And then when the spouse dies, they often then have problems. And that's when it began to emerge, and he had very bad depression. And then he began to talk about the war for the first time to me. I became very close to him. We were kind of thrown together in this situation. He began to share with me stories of the war. And it was horrific what he went through. That generation, again, horrific what they had to experience, you know.
And then I feel there was a sense of the hippie in you then as well, because you were headhunted from Cambridge, offered like top huge jobs in the corporate world and everything. And you turned it all down to stay in academia.
I did. And I kind of regretted it a bit. Two of us were headhunted into a big biotech company in Seattle.
Yeah.
My friend Tim Bird, he went. And he made millions from this, from his shares in the company. I went back to Trinity. And he used to send me messages. "You're still teaching those spotty teenagers," he'd say, you know, as he drinks Chateauneuf du Pape, this kind of thing, you know, just to wind me up, you know. But I wanted to go into academia, I realised. And I was partly to teach, first of all. And you're quite right, you can be a bit of an outsider in a university. We want outsiders to be in universities, free thinking kind of thing, you know. So I was drawn to that. And I think that was my father's influence. He would have hated me to go and work for a corporation, I imagine. You know, so that road I went down instead, you know.
Yeah, but you came good in the end then, as everybody knows. You sold your biotech company a few years ago.
Had to beat Tim Burr. That was my mission there.
And you did well. But the thing is, most of us are thinking then, okay, if I had the big payday, you know, you meet these guys, yeah, I sold my company, these men of leisure, you meet them various places around the place, and they always, they love to say, yeah, I've sold my company as well. But you sold the company and back into the lab the next day.
Oh, immediately. Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the company got bought by Roche in 2020, and now our drugs are in clinical trials in patients. That's what I wanted. I may have got some money out of it, but the whole purpose was to give it to a drug company because they're the ones who do the trials. And now Parkinson's, severe asthma and heart disease and are running as we speak. You see, it mightn't work. There's a high failure rate at this stage, remember. I keep going. You know, my next discovery might make the difference, you see. So back into the lab, that was always the plan, and now we're pursuing other ideas.
Did it really not change in any way the money, no?
You'd have to ask my friends. Yeah, that's yeah. I move in different circles now. No, I hope not.
So the drugs based on your research, yeah, then they're looking at what?
Parkinson's.
Say it again.
Parkinson's is the big one because yeah, there's a massive unmet need there. You know, severe asthma. There's still problems with asthma and heart disease. There's still even though there's treatments for these things, yeah, there's still a need for better meds.
You know? And is that all around inflammation?
It
then,
is,
yeah?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Are we learning that inflammation is at the root of, I don't know, practically everything? Like
we
they're
are
talking about depression and stuff
we
as well
are,
now,
yeah,
aren't they?
And that was my journey. In 85, I began working on Crohn's disease. That's how I got into all this.
Okay.
And then I began to work on other inflammatory diseases. And in the book, I mention this. They're all itises, arthritis.
Yes, I did not know that.
Yeah, that's right.
Now.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. And then I worked on rheumatoid arthritis. It turns out inflammation is at the heart of most diseases because it's used to fight infection and it's a great weapon when you're infected. The trouble is those weapons turn on your own tissues.
Okay.
And if it's arthritis, it's your joints. Parkinson's, it's your brain, and there's commonalities between them all. And again, we managed to find a key switch in the inflammatory process that our drug could block. So it's got potential then in many different diseases.
So whether it's your research or not, or something else, are we on the cusp of something huge here in terms of so many diseases?
We are.
Yeah, another leap forward. Yeah,
it's remarkable. I think cancer is the big one, and I've got a great story about cancer that illustrates this. A friend of mine in Australia called David Kenley on Christmas Eve was diagnosed with stage 4 malignant melanoma. This is a 6-month survival rate.
Okay, this is a skin cancer.
Skin
yeah.
cancer. Okay. He'd Mets, as they call them, in his brain and his lungs, right? He was told, look, this is very, very serious. They put him on checkpoint inhibitors. Now, I bet you wonder what they are. They wake up the immune system. And his immune system, within about 9-10 weeks, had cleared all the tumours, and he's still alive, and he's now cancer-free. Now, if you'd gone back 5 years, he'd be dead now, you know?
Wow.
That's how important those advances are. And the immune system being triggered was a wonderful idea, which people had for decades, and now they're managing to do that, to beat up the tumour, because obviously that's a very powerful thing to do.
So it is our immune system that fights cancer?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All the time, actually. As you and I speak, every day tumours grow in your body and the immune system kills them, you know, and eliminates them. And then sometimes they get a foothold and the immune system doesn't work as well. So the trick was always to get the immune system into shape. And these so-called checkpoint, the tumour actually puts down a checkpoint, literally,
okay,
to stop the immune system going in there, like a barrier, you
yeah
know. The checkpoint blockers stop the checkpoint going down, and now the immune system infiltrates the tumour and kills it. And David Kenley, I mean, he rang me, right? He said, thank you very much. I said, well, I didn't. He said, you're an immunologist. It's immunology saved me, he says, because it was the immune system that was
so
enabled.
This is a whole new wave of the cancer battle.
The huge optimism around cancer. And my mother, I mean, getting back to her, if
yeah
she was diagnosed now, she'd probably live with the type of breast cancer she had. You know, so the advances in that period then are striking.
Okay, listen, when people hear you talking about the immune system, it does trigger them slightly. Are you worried about COVID this winter?
Keep an eye on it is the best thing to say, but you know, because it's still there, obviously. It's another virus that joined all the other viruses that afflict us. We think flu jumped into us, you see, about 1,500 years ago, you know, and now COVID came along as another virus that caused respiratory disease. The concern isn't so much death, because the vaccines have worked. And there's boosters and people should turn up for their vaccines if they're over 60 and so on. But it's more the long COVID, you know, because that seems to be more troublesome with this virus than other viruses. So
okay,
that's one concern. So if you catch it, you mightn't die of it, but you might have long-term symptoms and they're very serious, like brain fog and all the, we all know what it is now, don't we? So that's more of the concern. But having said that, if you're vaccinated, you've got a good immune system, you'll clear the virus like anything else and you'll be fine. So people shouldn't worry about it. It wouldn't be fearful. It's up to the scientists to keep an eye on it.
Okay, but you would say it's not time to start people thinking, I've had enough vaccinations now.
Oh God, no. Well, as ever, and in the book, if I get back to it, the book describes the importance of vaccines as a discovery for humanity.
Yeah.
Vaccines have saved hundreds of millions of lives, especially children. children. And the Pasteur example, I talk about him in the book a lot. Three of his kids died. That motivated him to look for vaccines for diphtheria and for rabies. You know? So the history of vaccination is such an important thing for human health.
Are the vaccines for cancer more cancers on the way? I know we have the HPV, obviously. But
that's the next one. Absolutely. And in fact, the RNA technology that Kathleen Carrico won the Nobel Prize for, they're using RNA now to build a vaccine for cancers. And that's showing great promise as well. And one prediction will be most cancers, you could develop a vaccine. Now, remember, the vaccine gets the immune system to kill the tumour, a bit like the checkpoint. It's okay. A different way to do it. You know, there are so many companies out there, Brendan, pursuing immune activation to kill tumours. Some of this is definitely going to work, and it could be a vaccine could be part of that.
Okay. Not to be glib. So the question, what are we going to die of?
Boredom. Well, if we're lucky, we live to a ripe old age. And it's not so much about life. Remember, we've extended our lifespan in the past 60, 70 years. We've doubled it, you know. Yeah. That's a great triumph of science, isn't it? You know, what's the age? 80s now you can live to, you know. In Pasteur's day, it was 35 was the average lifespan, you see. So great successes there. We might live to 120. And if you're healthy, wouldn't that be great? That's the trick now, is health span more than lifespan. And what will we die of? We will die of old age. Nobody is immortal as far as we know. So old age will get you in the end.
And one of the, you talk about the things science hasn't licked yet, and aging is one of them.
Huge one. Yes, we'd love to understand the aging process and what's happening in the body, and can you slow it down? Now, aging's like an illness. You know, you can't walk as well. You know, you can't see as well, like an eye disease type thing. You can see aging as a kind of a disease in a way. If you could slow that down, then you won't have all these ailments. And cancer goes up with age as well, you see. That's one big reason to study aging.
You mentioned the long COVID there. I did ask you to have a look at this. Did you have a chance to have a look at this? So long cold can leave you feeling poorly weeks after sneezes stop. It's in a few of the papers today, but people suffering from long colds. I would say.
Is that man flu?
You can feel under the weather for weeks after initial symptoms have abated. More than 10,000 adults in the UK involved in the survey. 10% of people still have symptoms 4 weeks after the initial respiratory infection. Men, again, I'd say.
Exactly.
Do you think this, are we looking for too much now? Well, as
my book says, what's good science and what's bad science? Yeah. Good science is 10,000 people being studied. That means the results are probably correct. If you study five people, it could be biased in some way. 10,000 people studied and there's persistent symptoms after a cold. You know, things like fatigue. Now, again, they make the point it's a lot milder than long COVID. There's no brain fog with long cold. The symptoms are mainly fatigue and breathing maybe, and that's those kinds of things. And then it resolves. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That's cropped up now.
Yeah. And fatigue seems to be, is the big thing here, isn't it? And they're also saying that the chronic fatigue syndrome comes largely out of viruses and stuff.
Well,
like
one
that,
of the great thing, if I can use that word a bit about COVID, is there's much more serious attention now to chronic fatigue syndrome and ME. You may remember that. And they were difficult things to study. Some people didn't believe in them, you know, very real. And the long COVID experience tells us now there's millions of people with long COVID out there being studied at the moment. And they're all the same group of diseases. What's happening is you've cleared the infection. And your immune system is still a little bit active, still burning away, causing these symptoms. Fatigue is a symptom of infection. You're meant to lie down to allow your body to repair, you see. But the trouble is, it's still burning away. So all those diseases together now are in the spotlight because of long COVID.
Okay. Back to the book. We were talking about COVID there. And you do talk in the book about that anti-science feeling, conspiracy theories, is as old as science, really, isn't it?
Always there. Always been there. It seems a human instinctive response is to go after conspiracies. It's partly based on fear. They're trying to explain things. You go, you're drawn to a conspiracy theory, you know, and that's a big factor here. And of course, the point I make in the book is when science is a weapon against that. I see science as a way to say, no, that's not true. Here's the evidence for what I'm saying, you know. And my job all through the pandemic was simply to get the message out there from a scientific point of view. Of course, we're in a democracy. People can believe whatever they like, you know. But the great strength of science is it's backed up by data and evidence. And you can say, here's the data to counter that. And that's one of the key functions. I think the times we live in, all this misinformation, as you know, social media, the malignant influences there, we need science more than ever, I think, to counter that kind of thing.
And you talk as well about the abuse that you and other scientists in the COVID area took during the pandemic.
Yeah, that was tough at times. I had lots of death threats against me. There was a protest outside my house one Sunday, you know. It didn't bother me that much. I mean, it gave me pause for thought. It was more my family. They don't need that crap, do they? You know, I was putting that on them in a way through my media stuff. So that was more my concern. And then it was everybody got it. Anybody, many of the guests you would have had, same thing against them as well, you know. And then we kind of got used to it. The guards were very useful to me. Ben came to see me twice and advised me about what I should be doing and stuff, you know. The worst was in Trinity. They came into Trinity one day looking for me with placards saying "Kill Luke O'Neill," nooses, which are a thing to show on placards, it seems, nowadays. The trouble is they went to the neuroscience building. They didn't know where immunology was, presumably. You know? But Trinity were great. They gave me a bodyguard. Isn't that amazing? I had a bodyguard for 4 months. Great guy, Jer, if he's listening, ex-Irish Army guy. And he said to me one day, "Luke, my wife loves I'm your bodyguard because she loves you," he says. And I said, "Thanks for it." "Yeah, she's calling me Kevin Costner," he says. That was quite nice.
So you were in danger?
Well, the guard said no. The guard says most unlikely there'll be a physical attack here. You know, they said don't be worrying too much about it because it's mainly just protests. But still, you don't like having your life threatened, you know.
Yeah.
Just because you're speaking the truth on the radio, you know, that's what got me. It struck me, Brendan, we live in funny times if scientists need bodyguards, don't we? That seems a most alarming development.
And the flip side of that then is that, okay, you'd been knocking around and doing Pat Kenny and stuff like that and communicating science very well for years. It must have felt good to be able to do something so hugely useful that you probably never expected you were going to end up doing.
Unbelievable, and to be honest, unbelievable. And the gratitude, we were getting hampers of food into the lab, you know.
Yeah.
My favourite was a little old lady sent me in a crochet thing with hope on it, which was wonderful, you know. So the gratitude was great. And I think that was because people were so frightened. And I was just saying, keep going, you know. And I kept saying, the cavalry are coming. Thankfully, the vaccines arrived. So you're right, then. Never in my life would I think 25, 30 years of immunology would be so useful. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And obviously you'd rather it didn't happen, but And on conspiracy theories, you do talk about climate change in the book. We've more kind of bizarre weather today and bizarre weather. It's been 38 degrees, I think, in some places the other day and everything. And look, you obviously do accept climate change. It is real and all that. But again, Luke O'Neill positivity, you're saying we're not at a tipping point yet of this becoming irreversible.
Not yet. That's what the experts say, that, of course. I mean, the book is all of science, had to include climate change, didn't I, as a topic?
Yeah.
You know, I give the history of it and who made big discoveries. And by the way, a woman called Eunice Foote discovered greenhouse gases and she's unsung hero, you know. So, I talk about climate change and the evidence. I get lots of evidence for it now, you know. Now, whether we will reach the tipping point and how soon that's going to be, they don't know. It's a bit like COVID. There's many unknowns here, you know. But all the climatologists are worried, aren't they? We keep hearing it the whole time. And what gets me is it's our own technology's caused it, Brendan. Like, you know, we praise James Watt for the steam engine. Little did we know that would spew carbon to maybe destroy the earth. You know, he was a hero for so long, wasn't he? You know, and of course we can use technology to fix it is the hope. And again,
well that's it. Yeah.
Do you think
is technology going to have more answers over the next few years?
I think it has to. Yeah. I mean, there's a great line which Darren mentioned, Bono. He said to me, "We can't deny India air conditioning." You know what I mean? So in other words, we'll need technology to solve this, as well as our behaviour. It's a combination of the two that will get us through this. You know, and there's massive efforts now, renewables, but also carbon capture and various things are happening there. And again, science will hopefully prevail here.
Yeah. And I believe, in fact, the much maligned sphere is
carbon neutral.
Yeah, that's right. You say the big game-changing moments in science so far, according to the book, the invention of the World Wide Web, penicillin and home computers, I think, the big cultural moments. You kind of deal a bit with AI, but I guess it's early in the game and everything. Is AI the next big cultural science moment that's going to change everything?
Well, every so often we invent something new, you see. Did you know when handwriting was invented, when Plato spoke out against it, handwriting is a bad thing for students. It'll stop them thinking, you know. So AI is the latest thing to come along. What a great thing. I mean, that is speeding up drug discovery hugely. So for example, an AI system can now read 10,000 publications in 3 seconds kind of thing, you know, and you can ask it a question. It would take a human a long time to read those publications. So we're hopeful now that AI will help drug discovery for a start, and then other things as well. And then education, clearly. I mean, I'm a fan of it in education. So what we do at the moment is I'll get a student to give me an essay written by AI and critique it. yeah. orally, stand up and say, here's the AISA on the immune system, and this bit's wrong, because AI gets things wrong as well, and they might bring their own thoughts into it. You know, so you can use it as a tool.
Because that's the skill people are going to need, isn't it? Exactly. It's critical thinking around all this stuff.
Like, precisely.
Yeah. That list I mentioned that you have at the end of the book about things that science has yet to achieve, how the mind works is one of them. And you think, like, we do so much talk about mental health, neurology, the brain, everything. We're still very much shooting in the dark there, are we?
It's the single biggest mystery we now have in science. What is the mind and how does the mind work? And everybody agrees it's the big unknown, you know.
Okay, so we understand the brain to an extent, yes?
The bits. We understand about neurons, and I talk about that, who discovered those. You know, a guy called Golgi, actually. He was a scientist, gets credit. We understand neurotransmitters. They're the chemicals made in the brain. Martha Vogt, a great scientist, discovers acetylcholine, all that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
How does it fit together? We've no notion. What is memory? What's the basis for a memory? Completely unknown, you know. And to me, that's a great thing, because now anybody listening, become a scientist, because there's many unanswered questions. It's a bit like the immune system was 35 years ago when I began, by the way. That was a black box.
Okay.
Lots of the immune bits weren't known. Now we know a lot about the immune system. I predict in the book, rather boldly, we're going to learn about the mind more and more in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Do you think we'll understand consciousness?
That's the hope, yeah. I talk about a scientist called Carl Dieseroth. He's one of the famous scientists at the moment. They call him the Michael Jordan of neurosciences. And I met him. He was in Dublin, actually, 3 years ago. And he's trying to crack the basis for consciousness, you know. He's found
our knowing of our awareness of ourselves, kind of.
And he's found a protein in the brain called HCN1 that's involved in what's called dissociative states, when the brain seems to uncouple, you know, the mind and body seem to separate, you know.
Yeah.
He's seen as one of the people who might crack this, and he's invented a new technique, you know. And he said to me, and this, of course, is a bit showing off, he said, Ulysses was all very well by Joyce, but it's Finnegan's Wake describes consciousness. And I went, I'll get back to you on that, because it's bad enough reading the other season. So yeah, I think that will be the big advance. And it's so important, man. We need treatments for depression, schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. They're all brain diseases.
Yeah,
and how
can
we fix them if we don't know how the machine works? That's the idea. So understanding the mechanisms should help us come up with treatments for those diseases.
You've had touches of depression yourself at various times in your life.
I did. One bout, actually. Yeah, when my first son was born back in 1996, I had strange neurological symptoms at the same time, and that's what's going on here. That made me worry. About 3 months of depression. It was mild, and I didn't have to stop work or anything. Went to my GP. Very important. Anybody listening, if you're suffering, go and get help. You know, great GP gave me some meds. Did a bit of talk therapy, and after about 4 months, the clouds began to lift. So that was a tough old time. I think it was a combination of being a father and a potential awful neurological disease kind of combined. And we all have, you know, limits on what we can cope with. So that was a tough time.
Yeah, which science gave you an answer at that
stage. Well, yet
again,
I began to read about depression. And it's called a malignant sadness, is a great phrase that's used, because we all get down.
Yeah.
And if I can quote you too, you get stuck in a moment and you can't get out of it.
Okay.
And that's what it is, you know, and I learned. And the big thing for me was, I was a tutor in Trinity with lots of students. Many have mental health issues. I could empathize, having been through it myself. You know, it gave me a different perspective on what they were going through. So that was one thing I gained from
it. I never visited you since, really.
No. Again, I think I learned how to cope, I suppose, with what I went through.
Yeah. So lots of texts. Brendan and Luke, the advances in targeted cancer therapy are keeping me alive, says that person. Isn't that fantastic? Proton radiation as well, is that's a big game changer.
That's another one. Yeah. And dare I mention Marie Curie, another hero in the book. She discovered radioactivity and said radium could kill tumours, and that's what happened. You know, but there's other approaches that have been. There's so many different techniques against cancer now. It's remarkable.
Okay. Luke O'Neill's my hero. So inspiring. Delighted he's focusing on Parkinson's. I've suffered from over 20 years. I got it in my 40s. No one seemed to care. Really thrilled he's focusing on that. Good luck to him. There's a lot of people asking questions about their immune system and stuff like that. So just give me a brief answer. Foods, vitamins, any of
it's
that?
It's your best friend. That's what that, because it'll fight viruses and fight cancer. The usual things. Exercise.
Good
nutrition. Good night's sleep. And it's extremely important. Did you know a bad night's sleep, they've shown the next day, immune system is a third less effective just from a bad night's sleep. And maybe that's the day you sit beside the person on the dart who coughs all over you and you pick up the infection.
Try
and get a good night's sleep. And then de-stress. Stress is a big negative, you know.
Okay. So stress causes inflammation, doesn't it?
It does, and you make cortisol cortisol, and that suppresses the immune response. So there's various things. A healthy lifestyle is the best way to keep the immune system intact.
Yeah, but listen, sleep, if we could all get a good night's sleep, I presume we'd all be doing way better in life, mental health, everything. Like, it's key, isn't it? Luke, the book is called To Boldly Go Where No Book Has Gone Before, and it's published by Viking, and it's out now. And as I was saying to you, if I could follow these stories, anyone can, because I'm not scientific, but it is a great vast history of science. You've also written a children's book, Show Me the Signs, published by Gale.
That's right. That was the kids' version of Nevermind. Can I use the word bollocks? Here's the science.
You just did.
They made a teen version of that, which is really good for kids as well. Yeah. The more people can read science, the better, is my view, as you would understand, especially young people.
Okay. Well, look, I'm glad you kept working and you didn't head off and sit on an island somewhere on a beach with a beer. Luke O'Neill, thank you very much. We'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.